Hi, I'm Jeremy Goldman, and this is Future Proof. Today, we have a really exciting show because Advertising Week just finished up in New York recently, and I had a chance to sit down with two great figures who you probably heard of, Paul Bellantone, the president and CEO of the Promotional Products Association International, and then somebody who I've actually been familiar with for quite a while, Seth Godin. He's an author, entrepreneur, and a teacher. He has one of the most popular blogs in the world, and he's had 18 best-selling books that you probably read, like Purple Cow, Tribes, The Dip, and a whole lot more. So without further ado, here's Paul and Seth. You're going to hear Paul start off, and Seth joins us a few minutes through. Enjoy. Paul, welcome to Future Proof.
Well, thanks. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, so tell me, even though I know this already, tell our listeners your name and kind of your title and what you do on a day-to-day basis.
My name is Paul Bellantone. The association, I am the CEO and president of Promotional Products Association International, and I advocate for my industry. I try to make sure that my members are growing and protected and healthy and have the tools that they need to create really successful campaigns.
So it's interesting because I think when you think about the future, a lot of people are thinking about drones and augmented reality, and yet I think promotional products have a really clear tie to our heart. Everybody just gets a little bit happy when they see the right promotional product,
right?
The right tchotchke, as I would say. So,
but why you said the C word? You said the dreaded C word.
Yeah. why do you think that is in terms of why people naturally gravitate towards promotional products?
Well, I think people spend a majority of their time trying to avoid advertising. Their entire industries, companies, networks created just to avoid it. We're one that people are actually voluntarily consuming. So we break through clutter. And I think people like being given things. They like, promotional products is the one form of advertising. When you advertise to someone, they actually thank you. And I think it creates an affinity and a relationship with brands that they know and love.
Well, that touches, I think, on a really important thing, which is tying it back into the brand, into the product and what you're offering is. I mean, how important is it to kind of balance usefulness to the end user with also trying to have something that ties back to your brand in some way?
Right. You want to have some type of link back to the brand where it actually makes sense that you would expect that thing from that company.
So you were here talking with Seth Godin, right,
mm-hmm.
about the fundamentals of marketing.
Yes.
And tell me about kind of how that ties into what you do and also just what you both spoke about in your seminar this morning.
Well, Seth talked about keeping it simple, that he has this observation that the internet, and he's right, the internet is the only media that's been developed not to sell something. I mean, television was because you had products that needed to be sold, and radio, and so his feeling, my sense from reading his book and speaking with him, is that we've made the messaging too big and too broad. And he speaks to the minimizing it some. He said you have to market to your smallest possible audience. It's really making a connection with them. That's, to us, we work with Seth because we feel the same way. And our feeling is the more things are digital, the more that people want to have a relationship. And what Seth talks about a lot is his relationship to his tribe, to his group. And we have that same kinship. We have,
We're talking about you, by the way. No pressure.
There he is.
You know, Seth's in the background now, so.
So we talk about having promotional products that reach all five senses. I can give you something with taste and touch and sound. And there's a sixth sense, and it's a sense of ownership, and it's a sense of partnership with the person that that's actually going to be your brand steward.
That's a good riff.
I like that.
The one about the sixth sense.
It's pretty good.
The best.
I've never heard that before.
I feel like the best interviews are the ones that kind of become a multi-individual interview midway through. So, Seth, how's it going?
Hey,
how you doing, Jeremy? Yeah, it's great to be with you. We were just talking about this morning and kind of the commonalities between your work and really what you've been doing with respect to promotional products. I mean, how important do you think it is for people to
re-embrace the fundamentals of marketing instead of just forgetting that ultimately it's about selling a product at the end of the day.
I don't think it's ultimately about selling a product at the end of the day. I think it's about making change happen. And if that change happens to align with you being able to have a commercial transaction with somebody that fuels your ability to make more change, then you're a professional marketer. But the idea that you need to get the person to sign on the line that is dotted and always be closing because it's good for you, that doesn't work in an economy. That doesn't work in an economy where trust and attention are as scarce as they are now.
Yeah, I mean, I feel like a lot of also your work talks about being customer-centric, customer-first. I mean, is that something that is lost on a lot of brands these days? What do you guys think?
Well, I think that everybody's trying to reach everyone. And I think when you do that, you've actually made it appealing to no one.
Yeah.
So for me, it's as simple as if you can have your, from our industry standpoint, if I can make a potential customer say thank you when I'm advertising to them, then I've won. I've separated myself from everybody else along the way.
Because you're reinforcing your brand on an ongoing basis to them, yeah?
And I'm creating a relationship that they can't hit delete on. You look somebody in the eye, you shake their hand, you give them something, they like that.
Yeah, yeah, no, absolutely. I mean, another thing actually that people have liked about the show so far is the very quick, irreverent lightning round that we kind of give people one-line answers to a few questions, if you guys are ready.
Ready.
All right.
Let's go.
Okay, Seth, most fun you've had writing any of your books?
I wrote Unleashing the Idea Virus and The Dip between them in 39 days in just a blizzard of bringing it to the world. The reason it was fun is before I wrote Unleashing the Idea Virus, I thought I was never going to write another book again. And Malcolm Gladwell sent me a copy of The Tipping Point. It just clicked, and the book came out. Clearly, I'd been thinking about it.
39 days. As an author, that makes me kind of hate you, but okay. Yeah.
But then I've had other books. The other book I had the most fun writing was Survival Is Not Enough, which took 8 hours a day for a year and involved me reading more than 100 books on evolution. I loved that because that let me pretend I was a scholar, and I learned so much doing it. It didn't sell any copies, but it was still worth doing.
Yeah, no,
that's more than one line.
But that's growing yourself at the same time, which any good marketer I feel like has to do. So, Paul, most interesting promotional product that you've ever seen?
I was once given it was interesting to me because it was one of those things that didn't fit the place where I was. I was on a trade show floor in Guadalajara, Mexico, 30 years ago, and a man shook my hand and handed me a jar opener, like a rubber jar opener. The interesting thing was I didn't realize it at the time. He was the president of Promotional Products Association International, and I would become the president of that organization. And I said, what a weird thing to give somebody in the middle of a trade show for,
right.
But he always carried around some promotional product with him. So
that's great.
Jar opener.
And that's your like superhero origin story, kind
it,
of.
It is exactly. A little bit there. It's funny, out of all of the things that I can get and all of the things that I do get from my members, that's one that holds a soft spot
sure.
in my heart.
That's amazing. Seth, favorite city in the world to speak?
To speak? There's no question it's New York City because A, I hate airplanes, and B, because people get my jokes.
I'm going to do stand-up for my 40th birthday in a week or two, and I think that people will get my Yiddish jokes here. If I go to Nashville,
birthday.
Not so much.
Yeah,
probably not.
Paul, so what innovator do you most admire, anybody that you're following right now and learning from? Can't be Seth.
See, that's my 14-year-old son.
Yeah,
good
for
you.
He
innovates every single day. He comes up with a creative way of approaching things. He's so far out of the box. And the positive side of manipulative, I would say, he's very persuasive, but he's constantly innovating. He always has plan B going in the back of his mind.
Beautiful.
So it's sometimes you don't have to look too far away to be motivated and inspired.
Wow, that's great. That's look forward to the day when I can say that about my kids, so...
How old are your kids now?
Oh, 5 and 2.
The 5-year-old. First of all, the 2-year-old can walk, right?
Oh, yeah.
Which, he or she?
He.
He learned by failing and failing and failing. No one tries to walk, can't do it, and says, nah, never going to do it. And that method, which works so well for walking and talking, suddenly we turn 10 and we never want to do it again. But innovation is nothing but exactly the same way that we learned how to walk.
Yeah. Wow, I never really thought about it that way. And they are very entertaining, but I think, if anything, I get material from being a parent. But I think to learn as an innovator, that's where I'm going to work to... Okay, so two more questions. Big interest of yours, Seth, that most people don't know about.
I'm one of the world's best style canoeing instructors, and I've been doing it for 43 years. I go up to Canada to teach people how to get in a 17-foot long wooden boat and make it sing and dance and go sideways and frontwards and backwards. And in doing so, I help 12-year-olds realize they have more power than they thought they did.
That's amazing.
Wow.
Paul, if last one, if you could listen to only one musical artist for the rest of your life, who would it be?
Billy Joel.
Billy Joel.
I'm a New Yorker. I'm a piano player.
There you go.
That was not even, you didn't even have to think. That was,
we
did not cut out any dead silence there. That was an instantaneous answer.
And I missed him by one night. He was playing here Sunday night.
Right. My Sam, who I work with, went to see him.
Yeah. Envious. So for both of you, I wanted to ask, obviously the marketing landscape is changing very rapidly these days, and I think a lot of people are paying attention to what is going to be the next biggest technology. In a lot of ways, what I like about what you both are doing here is that you're talking about the fundamentals and kind of bringing it back a few steps and saying, what are you ultimately trying to accomplish? So what are there any particular changes over the next few years that you're paying attention to, and do you think that there's any risk in paying too much attention to changes in technology and how marketing is evolving?
Thank you, Fatima. This is one of my rants. And if you want to future-proof yourself, you realize the next big thing is 20 years old.
Yeah.
Right? But the next big thing is you are a click away from a billion people if they want to hear from you. So maybe you missed being first on Facebook. Maybe you missed being first in blogging. That doesn't matter. What matters is there's a human being out there who, if you build the right thing, will want to hear from you. And any time you're spent distracted by virtual reality or some other nonsense is wasting your opportunity to do that. You know, the fact is 100 years from now, the same way we think back of what we would have done when the assembly line was new, they're going to be saying 100 years from now, oh, that's what you were doing when you could have earned trust and attention?
Yeah. Because I think, like with a lot of people, there's always something 20 years later where you look back and you say, what were we thinking, right? So in a lot of ways, it's right now we're kind of thinking technology first and, methodology or strategy second.
Yeah, well said.
What do you guys think about, so obviously you're talking about, Paul, about advocating for promotional products in general. Is there some type of danger in... not acknowledging one's biases when they're trying to predict the future? So you're thinking about a particular, constituency, which is the promotional products industry. So how do you reconcile that with just trying to actually be accurate in terms of forecasts? Everybody has an incentive to think that their own industry or their own constituency is going to grow, but how do you reconcile that?
I'm going to go to something that Seth wrote years ago. And just because a trade association says it doesn't make it so. And you've done something on smoking in restaurants. And
right, I remember that one.
The associations that were supporting, the restaurant associations that were saying, they were on the wrong side of history on that one. And you look at it. So we're always a little bit, I like less regulation in business. And I want the government to spend more money on promotional products. I think that it helps them get responses that they want because it changes behavior. But I'm also a taxpayer. And I don't want their dollars being used frivolously. I want them to be used purposefully to get something done. So I think we all strike that balance. I know that our members are always trying to make sure that products are safe. They're generally low-cost products that are being imported. We try to make sure that they're safe. My members would argue that, we need less regulation. But I'm a father, and I also want to make sure that the things that we're putting into the marketplace are safe and compliant. I look at it like this, whether I'm shopping in Nordstrom's or Walmart, I know in Nordstrom's I'm going to get more style, I'm going to pay more money, it'll probably be better, well made. But I never shop in Walmart and say to myself, well, I wonder if the stuff here is safe. So no matter how much money you're spending, I want to make sure that it's in the marketplace the way it should be in the marketplace.
That's fantastic.
I love that. It's
full-time job, Seth.
No, that's great stuff.
So, and Seth, what do you think about that? Because I think, obviously, everybody has biases when they're trying to figure out where the market's going to be, and how do you kind of acknowledge those?
Yeah, you know, I made a $40 billion mistake. You only need to make one of those in your career. I ran the biggest and first email marketing company in the world in 1992, and the World Wide Web came along in 1993, and I said, this is nonsense. It's not going to work. It has no business model. It's slow. It's clunky. And I missed it completely because I said, I make email, how will this help me? I didn't say, if I had a clean slate, what would I do with this? And so I've worked since then to strip away. I don't own stock in any companies. I don't do consulting. I don't have any clients. So I can say, I was wrong about that tomorrow and do a completely different thing. Now, that doesn't make me perfect, but it makes it easier to not be a hypocrite, right? Mm-hmm. And so, yes, we have a bias for the familiar. We have a bias for competence. And so part of my work in the studio is, how can I make myself incompetent? How can I destroy the thing that got me here intellectually? Because otherwise, I will miss the next version of the World Wide Web. So I probably am wrong about virtual reality. I just know that my timing so far is correct. One day, there's going to be a thing. I just don't think it's worth holding my breath for. But that's partly because I feel incompetent when I put on those goggles. And I don't like feeling incompetent. So my work is intentionally making myself feel incompetent so that I could find an explanation that maybe someone else missed.
But that actually makes a lot of sense, because we're ultimately talking about essentially, whenever you go into any new industry, it's almost like you're auditing what they're doing from a point of ignorance, which means you don't have a bias towards the way that things were done previously either, right?
Exactly.
I have a mentor, someone on my board, who gave a quote that we use. It's better to be nimble than to hope for clairvoyance. So create a lean, nimble organization that's able to take advantage of these things as you see them.
Sure.
You can choose. Not be too tied down.
Yeah. If failure is not an option, then neither is success.
Love that. Quotable. I actually want to ask, speaking about that, when you're talking about failure, and I think you guys touched on this morning, but how does an organization know that they have a marketing problem in the first place?
Well, if you think you have a marketing problem, you definitely do. That in my book, I talk about the symptoms of a marketing problem, and they are: if the people you seek to reach and the people you seek to change and the people you seek to engage with aren't engaging with you, that is the definition of a marketing problem.
And how many people do you think who have a marketing problem right now are even aware that they do?
Because I think the people who care are very well aware of it. They're just finding the wrong way to solve it. They think the way to solve it is by telling more people. And that is what's driving almost all marketing spend, is alert everyone. And alert everyone is never the right path.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it kind of goes to what you were talking about before, about making sure that you're talking to the right people instead of just everybody. I mean, what do you think that has something to do with fear, that people just try to actually reach out to everybody as opposed to just really segment and hone in and develop a beautiful message just for the right person?
Yeah, I'll just jump in here really quick. It's super simple. If you say there are only 5 humans on Earth who this is for, and they turn you down, you're busted. Whereas if you say this might be for everyone, you can just keep propositioning people all day long because hope is right around the corner. And so the essence of the smallest viable audience is have the guts to say who it's for before you bring it to the world. And if it's not for them, you just learned something really important. Go make something better.
So do you think, Seth, that that's marketers being lazy when they do it the other way? Or
it's marketers being selfish, narcissistic short-termers. It's not marketers saying, I am so, it's like the person goes to a singles bar and walks up to every single person to proposition them, because I'm so magical. Someone's got to love me, right? And marketers are under a lot of pressure. The boss says, get me more. They get, you know, the fancy plane rides, and they get the all the other stuff, but they got to produce, and the way they think they're supposed to produce is by spamming everyone.
I mean, I'll just say, as a marketer, I think that there are plenty of you know, companies that I've worked with that they do it a little bit out of fear, where they say, you know what, I'm not going to hit my numbers. Maybe if I, you know, spray and pray, hit as many people as possible with messages, and it comes from a feeling of not entirely being confident in your message. And if you feel that you've got a message that is going to resonate with 10 people, get in front of those 10 people.
Right.
Yeah. So how about also, I think another thing that you talked about, which I think is very important, and, you know, we kind of touched on it a little bit before, is that better is up to the users,
right?
And not, it's not your definition of what's better.
Exactly.
It's them. So how do organizations, for both of you, how do you think that organizations can get better at listening to their users to develop something that the user will say, yes, this is better, yes, this is solving my problem?
From my business, running a trade association, it's pretty, I think it's easier to do. It's easy to put a value on something and say, if you're a member, you get it for half the price. But really, the only member benefit that a member will pay for is something that they would have had to do on their own without you. If you're discounting your education by 50%, they don't believe in education. It doesn't matter how much you discount it. But, you know, the reason why we've become a stronger organization is we do a lot of lobbying and advocacy work. Our members can't do that on their own. They want to, but they can't afford to. So for us, it's actually trying to figure out what the members want, when what they're doing day to day, and then we try to fill that space. A little bit different than I think.
It's a great way to go at it. You know, here's the way I'll talk about better. From where I sit, nothing Apple has done in the last 4 years is better. I don't want a phone that's what they're building, and the Macs they're selling aren't better than the one I have that's 4 years old. But it's not for me. So to Tim Cook's credit, he said, I'm going to make the stock price go up, and he said, I'm going to make a product not for Seth. So it's better for some people, but not better for me. That's the right way to do it. The wrong way to do it is to say, I need to make more money, so I am going to announce my version of better and insist that the world like it. That's not the point. The point is, better is always in the eye of the consumer. That's what better is. So you have to have this radical empathy to say, I forgive you for being who you are. I forgive you for wanting what you want and believing what you believe. I don't know what you know, and I don't see what you see. But given who you are and what you've chosen, I think this might be better for you. And that leap is really difficult to make, because marketers don't take their job because they want to be subservient. They take their job because they want to be in charge.
That's really powerful when it works, though.
Yeah.
I mean, I think there are a lot of, like you talked about, the narcissism inherent in it, and it almost gets me thinking as to, there's kind of a certain Don Draper Mad Men perception that everybody's aspiring to in the marketing world, but it almost makes me think, if the marketer of tomorrow, when we're talking, you know, 20 years from now, 10 years from now, that skill set will be different than the skill set.
It's the marketing of right this minute. I mean, you know, if we look at someone like Amanda Palmer, who did the most successful music Kickstarter in history, raised $1.2 million in 30 days. Amanda Palmer got kicked off of her record label as a failure, because she only sold 20,000 records of her last record. Her Kickstarter, which broke every record, 20,000. Same number, right? So what Amanda's doing is saying to her audience, here I am. Come here if you want me. She's not saying to the world, I insist on being on Top 40 Radio. She's not trying to be the next Britney or whatever the person of the moment is. She's saying, I'm going to be this version of Amanda. And if you find that that's better, because I see you, I think you will come along.
So, I mean, I think that in some ways that's that touches on, I feel like, a really important thing, which is the fragmentation of media, right? I mean, now you have so many different outlets to find something. Is Top 40 dead? Is it going to still matter? We talk about when I go on Audible and I look to see how many different niches.
Exactly.
Pretty much everybody can be a number one in any one area. So is that a trend that is going to continue ad infinitum? Or do we kind of imagine that there will be a point that this... Is fragmentation a fad? Or is this just the new normal?
Yeah, there are two things that are going on at the same time. If you get into an Uber or a Lyft, you know one thing is true. They have a smartphone. And yet, they're often listening to the radio. When they, for free, could be listening to the music they want to listen to with no ads. They're listening to the radio. Why are they doing that? Because there's a community campfire element of people like us do things like this. We are all in sync, right? So that, the Super Bowl mindset of we all got around the campfire tonight, that doesn't go away for a long time. But as a practical matter, it's already over. As a practical, you know, if we look at a show as successful as Seinfeld was, Seinfeld's ratings on a regular basis were less than a quarter what MASH's were. Same TV slot went down 75%. And now we're a fraction of that. So that's not ending. The idea that there's going to be a hit TV show ever again is over. Mad Men, which we talked about, at its peak, had 3 million viewers. 3 yeah. million, 1% of the population watching what some people say is the best TV show ever made. 1%.
You know, it almost gets me thinking, it's interesting, what Seth's talking about is that, you know, with all of this fragmentation, is there any type of danger of creating a promotional product that is almost too good? So do you want to create something that only attracts the right people as opposed to everybody? Do you want people to come over to your booth who are totally inappropriate for your product because you're giving something away that's general purpose? Or do you need to try to figure out what is the thing that's going to get only the right people in? Or should that be the goal?
That is exactly it, and it's the fidget spinners. I mean, we commoditized that so quickly. It was huge. It hit our industry. A lot of people made a lot of money very quickly, but there's a lot of people with fidget spinners sitting in warehouses because
right.
they were doing it because it was popular, not because it was right. I'll tell you a quick story. My dad, 10 years ago when he was 70, was in a mall. He wanted to buy a computer, and they had the kiosks in the mall, and he went through a demonstration. And they gave him a flash drive. And my dad had no idea what a flash drive was, and it scared him. It scared the heck out of him. Like, you're going to get all of that information onto this flash drive. And he walked away from the sale, and he didn't buy the computer. They didn't ask him why he wanted the computer, and it was really so that he can communicate with his grandchildren. And they should have given him a mouse pad with, you know, that has the cutout where you can put the picture in it. So for me, I would have loved the flash drive. You know, it's exactly what I use. I use them all the time. But for a 70-year-old guy who didn't understand technology,
right. yeah.
he got a flash drive. And very well-intended, the company that did it. They probably spent a lot of money on those flash drives, I hope. And
yeah, I mean, one of the challenges, just like network TV isn't responsible for who's making the ads and how they make them, sometimes people who buy promotional products don't exercise good judgment, and they don't spend the right kind of money. They say, what's cheap and what's easy? Oh, a ballpoint pen, a squeezy ball, whatever. Those don't work. And no one said they did, right? That the whole point is to be a meaningful specific, not a wandering generality.
Yeah. Yeah. I think, just since I know we've got to let you guys go in a minute or two, but I want to ask you, what is one current trend that you're paying close attention to right now that is just going to be an interesting thing to watch over the next 3 years in the world of marketing?
Well, from my perspective, what my members are watching are tariffs and the geopolitical environment, because a lot of our products are imported. So we keep an eye on that. We try to keep them informed on that, because they have to make good business decisions based on pricing. And it's changing the way our industry goes to market a little bit. You know, you can't guarantee a price in a catalog for a year anymore if you don't know whether or not you're going to have a 10% or a 25% increase. So that's affecting our industry.
It's interesting. I just want to say, I think that everybody generally will say drones or, you know, deep learning. And sometimes there are basic business fundamentals behind these things that really impact the direction that an industry is going to go. So I love that.
I think it's always the business fundamentals that do it.
Yeah.
For me, it's kindness. Things go in cycles, and I'm waiting for the kindness cycle to come back.
And thank you so much, Paul, Seth. That was a really great conversation, I got to say. Just really, I love whenever we're able to talk to people about not just the future, but also the fundamentals that will help them master marketing as time goes on and as we have access to all these interesting new technologies and platforms. As always, just make sure to rate and review us on Stitcher, Apple Podcasts, and wherever finer podcasts are sold and or downloaded. And until next time, I'm Jeremy Goldman, and you've been listening to Future Proof.